was born in a small town in rural Japan, population 18,000. My parents met in Tokyo, a city of 8 million in 1980, neon lights where my mother had grown up and spent her whole life. But then my dad got transferred to this tiny, tiny town, and so my mom quit her job and moved with him. That's where I was born, and for the first few years of my life, much of what I remember about my parents' relationship and our family is based on what you might expect would be very traditional gender roles based on Japanese culture. My father worked 6 days a week, long hours, often leaving before I was awake and coming home after I went to bed. And my mother raised me and ran the household. Around the same time, there's a really popular Japanese TV show about three kids, two boys and a girl. One of the boys was big and athletic. Another of the boys was a nerd. And the girl took care of them both. And this was a very, very popular show, but my mother refused to let me watch it, hating the gender stereotypes it portrayed. Why should the nerd be a boy? Why should the girl always have to take care of the other two? And so despite the fact that my immediate environment may have been superficially very, very driven by these gender stereotypical roles, my mother thought very carefully about the types of messages I was receiving as a child. And perhaps because of decisions like these, I decided to go to college in the States. We'd moved abroad when I was young, and my parents' roles shifted over time. But when I thought about pursuing higher education in Japan and spending my adult life in that country, I felt suffocated by the expectations of women in Japan, to be polite, to be obedient, to be well-mannered. While some women choose to become powerful women within that system and change it from within, I knew that that life was not for me. So I ended up in Connecticut, 7,000 miles from Tokyo, where my parents were at that point. I spent a lot of time in undergrad playing with non-human primates. I became fascinated by the evolution of the human mind. And so I played with chimps, I played with lemurs, I played with rhesus macaque monkeys, I played with capuchin monkeys. I had such a blast. One Thanksgiving break, I had spent the entire week on the small island off the coast of Puerto Rico. This was not as glamorous as you might think. I was mosquito bitten, I was sunburnt. We only had cold showers because turning on the hot water in our little apartment meant that you had to suffer this electric zap because you had to turn on the water first. And I had spent the week lugging this enormous apparatus made out of foam core and duct tape, as all good scientific experiments use, around this tiny island studying monkey deception. So the idea here was to determine whether monkeys could determine whether we could see something, and if they would use that information to then try to deceive us and steal a grape. And I was lugging around this heavy thing all around the island and trying to get enough data for this paper, and I was getting so excited, and I would email my mother often about my adventures or misadventures in the lab, on the field, in the classroom. And when I told her that I had spent the week studying monkey deception, she told me about my very first lie. So she had handed me some scissors and some paper to play with and walked away. And when she came back, she found that my pants were just shredded. And so she looked at me and said, "Did you do this?" And I looked at her, and I looked at my pants, and I looked at the pair of scissors in my hand, and I looked at her again and said very seriously, "No, Mama." And so whether it was a small apartment in rural Japan or this small island off the coast of Puerto Rico, 20 years apart, my mother and I were both studying instances of primate deception. Given my love of primates, I think my mother worried that I was going to go off and become a primatologist, which in her mind meant that I was going to spend my life in some remote, foreign, beautiful forest chasing after creatures she'd only imagined. And the only way that she would hear from me was by this torn, wrinkled postcard that would mysteriously arrive in the mail every few months. To her relief, I decided to study another foreign creature, which is the human child. And a few years ago, I now have my own daughter. She's almost two. And I'm a developmental psychologist. I study how kids' minds work. And this is what I do for a living. I think about how kids' minds work. This is what I teach about. This is what my research is on. And so as my partner and I were thinking about going for our ultrasound where we might find out the sex of the baby growing inside of me, I also found myself just 24 hours before the ultrasound standing in front of a classroom talking to my students about gender development. It turns out that adults treat boy babies and girls babies differently. If you are to show a newborn adult to a newborn baby to an adult, they might comment on how strong his kicks are or how smart he looks. And if you show an adult a newborn baby girl, they might say, oh, she's so social, or look at her pretty eyelashes. Now, the trick here is that the babies are the same. So the exact same babies, their own behaviors are interpreted differently based on what we just tell the observer, whether it's a boy or a girl. Kids listen to these messages. You can tell an 18-month-old toddler, you can ask them these questions and they'll tell you that Annie is more likely to be helping in the kitchen and Johnny is more likely to be spending his time climbing trees. And so I thought about whether the knowledge of the gender, the sex of my fetus 24 hours from then was really fundamentally going to change the way that I thought about this fetus growing inside of me and what types of messages I was sending to the baby or to the world about my expectations of his or her behavior. My mother decided that she didn't want to expose me to this TV show, hoping that I could go beyond the stereotypical gender roles that were playing out in our household day to day. And I desperately hoped that by choosing not to trace delicate figures on my stomach, encouraging the girl inside to be considerate or kind, I could instead give her a huge bear hug and hope that she would be assertive and brave. My daughter was born 1 week late. She decided to take her time until we reminded her that an eviction notice was coming soon. And she decided to come out the way that she deemed appropriate, which involved pushing for hours upon hours on my spine. And so assertive might be one way to describe her. She's growing up to be quite the outspoken toddler. And on the surface, my relationship with my daughter might look quite different from my mother's relationship with me. When they placed this baby on top of my stomach seconds after she was born, my first thought was, my God, that's a person. And I should have known that, right? Not only because she came out of my uterus and what was I gonna have, a puppy? And I'd seen the ultrasounds where I saw that she had my nose and not my husband's, and I'm a developmental psychologist, right? This is what I do for a living. My mother, when I was young, told me that Elvis Presley died of a donut overdose, that he'd become hopelessly addicted to donuts, that was all he wanted to eat, and his health was deteriorating and his weight was ballooning, and scientists all over the world invested in his life were trying to figure out ways to save him. So they were inventing things like broccoli-filled donuts, but to no avail, until he ultimately died of a donut overdose. And I totally believed her until I was 23. And in a PhD program. And so as a developmental psychologist now facing parenthood, I was hoping that the words donut overdose might never come out of my mouth. So my daughter was born with a mild case of torticollis, which is when essentially there's not a ton of room in the uterus for a fetus. And so they're a little scrunched up inside, and so one side of the muscles on her neck is a little bit tighter than the other. Her case was very mild, and the doctor said, oh, what you need to do is encourage her to look to the right, because she prefers to look to the left. You can position yourself to her right. You can put some interesting toys on her right side, and that's going to help her overcome this torticollis. Now, my psychology training that told me that I could actually do one step better, and I decided to fix this using operant conditioning. So operant conditioning is the same process that you use when you're, for example, trying to train your dog to perform tricks, or in classic psychology experiments, when you're trying to train a rat to press a lever or a pigeon to flap its wings. The basic idea is that you reward the behavior that you want to elicit. So as soon as a dog might raise his paw, or a pigeon flaps her wings open, or a rat places their hands on or their paws on the lever, you reward it. Usually this is with food. But my daughter around this time was starting to take to a pacifier, which kept her pretty happy until it fell out of her mouth, and then it was a disaster until someone helped her out. So I decided to reward her for looking right. So if she was looking to the right and the pacifier fell out, I would immediately put it back in her mouth. And if she was looking to the left, I would take a few extra seconds until the pacifier made it into her mouth again. And I'm happy to report that my toddler daughter, almost two, is symmetrical and and happy. So on the surface, I think that my relationship with my daughter is not very similar to the relationship that my mother had with me. I work full-time, so she's in full-time daycare. She's going through quite a papa-only phase right now. The other morning, I walked into her room, and she said, "Mama, out." But when I look at my daughter, even though I've had 15 years of training as a developmental psychologist, I don't see a research subject. What I do see, though, is this complex human mind. It's calculating, it's digesting, it's absorbing, and it's the same mind that my mother must have seen in me when she looked at me. And while my mother has these hilarious anecdotes to tell about my childhood, what I have are anecdotes with science and data. When she was young, my husband and I would often keep track of her bowel movements, which is really useful information to have so you know what to expect. And the data from that effort was recently used in a statistics class. And so when I think about the fact that one day my daughter might ask me, "Mama, how did Elvis Presley die?" I think about the fact that I approach parenting scientifically. And I might actually tell her the same story that my mother did. But then I can keep data on how long it takes for her to figure it out. Thank you.